in and complained that it was unfair. I should have gotten that promotion. I shouldn't have been reprimanded for X. You may have a complaint of wrongful discharge. That may come in through an email from an employee. It may come in through a letter from an attorney, maybe a lawsuit. There may need to be an investigation. You may have received a charge from the Maine Human Rights Commission. I need to investigate for the purpose of putting together your submission. You may get a customer complaint about poor service by an employee or patient abuse in the medical field. Or maybe it's a student administrator issue. You could get a complaint that one employee has threatened another employee and you need to investigate. You may have a complaint of unsafe conditions in the workplace. It could be an anonymous complaint. It could be a signed complaint. Employees could be complaining about being required to work off the clock. Or you may have a workplace accident with some question about whether drugs or alcohol was involved. So those are, I'm just trying to give you a flavor of the kind of situations that you may encounter. One of the questions that you may encounter is, should I investigate this particular complaint? So the question might be, should I investigate this particular complaint? Do I need to investigate everything? So, for example, what if you get an allegation from an anonymous source saying the CEO is having an affair with some unnamed person? Should you investigate that allegation? And if so, how would you go about investigating it? Some of you are shaking your head, shrugging your shoulders. This is a situation that I've dealt with in the past. It's a tough call, particularly if you're reporting to the CEO. But it's a balancing act that you've got to think about. You know, you have a duty to investigate, perhaps. Under some legal theories, you may have a duty to investigate. Or you may have a reason to investigate to prevent harm. But sometimes the investigation itself causes more harm than it benefits the organization. So investigating an anonymous complaint about an affair with a person you don't even know, if you went through and started questioning all the employees about, do you know anything about an affair between the CEO and somebody else, obviously you're going to cause a lot of reputational damage, maybe unnecessarily and unfairly. But you might go to the CEO and say, look, we've gotten this complaint, which is concerning. Can you think of any reason why we might have gotten that? Or you may have, under your code of conduct, you may have an obligation to report the incident to your board of directors or other overseeing trustees, etc. So you want to check that and see whether you have a duty to report it, even though it's an anonymous complaint. And, you know, if you do have a duty to turn it over to another higher level, then you've satisfied your obligations without having to really get involved in something you probably don't want to get involved in. So there's a balancing act there. You've got a complaint or a situation, and you have to decide how you're going to address it. One of the things you're going to think about before you even start investigating or start looking for an investigator is, you know, what are the reasons for the investigation? And these are not official terms, but I've categorized them into determinative and defensive. And an investigation may have both. For an example of a determinative purpose is to figure out whether disciplinary action should be taken in response to employee misconduct. Another thing is you're trying to determine whether there was an injustice or a mistake made by management. Just trying to determine the facts. You might have to determine whether you need to make the workplace safer or to correct a compliance problem before it becomes a legal issue. An investigation may also have a defensive purpose, and that's perhaps you need to investigate in order to provide a defense to a claim, say a claim of sexual harassment, as we've talked about in other seminars. In some cases, particularly with coworker harassment, or harassment that doesn't involve any kind of adverse job action, the employer has a defense if they do a prompt and thorough investigation and take appropriate remedial action. Even if they're mistaken on their final conclusions, it's the investigation that is the defense. So that might be a big reason why you're doing it. You might want to be defensive in the sense of, I've got to pin down witness statements while they're fresh in people's minds, and to avoid later exaggeration. Maybe you need to do an investigation so you can obtain a legal opinion on what to do next. So you're doing the preliminary investigation so that you have facts to share with your legal counsel. And there may be a situation where you either got actual litigation or anticipated litigation, and you want to do an investigation there. So it's important to sort of think through what are the reasons or what are the purposes of the investigation. So the first decision you have to make is selecting the investigator. And some people sort of just gloss over that and don't really think through the implications of it. But it may not be you, even though you may not be the appropriate investigator, even though maybe that's your job most of the time, or the person came to you and you're the one handling it. So you want to step back and think, what's the purpose of the investigation? How could this end up being used? And that's going to be a factor in deciding. You need to have somebody who's impartial. So if you have a particular relationship with either complainant or respondent, you might not be the best person. Objective and fair, someone who's respected within the workplace. Now, maybe an outside person who would be more respected than the people you have available to do investigations. You need somebody who's skilled, experienced, and knowledgeable in investigating complaints. It's helpful to have somebody with good listening skills. Another factor is the person has to be available. And that's kind of tricky sometimes. You sometimes have to drop everything and dive into it for days at a time. So that sometimes narrows the scope. You want somebody who's a clear writer, and that's particularly true when you're doing a defensive investigation that's going to have multiple audiences afterwards. In some cases, you're going to want somebody who's also an effective witness. What I'm looking at for outside investigators, particularly when there's litigation, I want somebody who can investigate well, write a good opinion, but how are they going to stand up on the stand if we get that far? In some situations, you will have a single investigator, and sometimes you'll have to have a team. A client of ours did an investigation last week in which they had to interview 20 people in the course of a day. So they had a team of people with a script of questions, and that was really the only practical way to do the investigation. Sometimes you're going to want a primary investigator with a note taker. If you've done investigations, it can be very difficult to ask good questions, listen to the answers, and write them down, and have a good record afterwards. And so having a note taker can be very effective. That person's not asking questions, but sitting back, and may have some useful insights afterwards. And lastly, it must be somebody who's legally permitted to investigate. And this is an issue that's becoming more and more prominent, particularly in a number of states like California and New York, where the legal issue is being challenged. And what do I mean by that? Most states have a statute that regulates who can conduct an investigation as a professional investigator. And if you're not a person who is, and the answer is you have to be licensed by the state to conduct investigations, unless you fall within one of the several exceptions. And so to be licensed as a professional investigator, you have to go through a process with Maine State Police if you're in Maine. Massachusetts has a similar process. You have to show a specific set of educational backgrounds, number of years of experience in conducting investigations or in law enforcement. In a lot of states, you have to take an exam, and then you are licensed. There are exceptions to the licensing requirement that will accept most of you in this room, and that's if you're essentially just inquiring into an applicant's suitability for employment with that person's employer. So anybody in your recruiting department. An attorney admitted to practice in the state and acting in a professional capacity. And your current employees, employed exclusively and regularly by an employer in connection with the affairs of the employer only, and there exists a bona fide employer-employee relationship. So your in-house human resource people can conduct investigations. There are a number of other exceptions, which I don't think are relevant to very many people here. But this means that, and I've explored this issue with the Maine State Police and the personnel that kind of govern the licensing process. This means that an outside HR consultant who's not licensed to be a private investigator cannot legally conduct an investigation for an employer. Now, I argued with them about, well, what about an HR consultant who's employed or on contract to essentially run the HR department? The answer I got was, it might make sense to have them be allowed to conduct investigations, but that's not what the law says. So that may be something, you know, I think that there are a lot of very skilled HR consultants who could conduct excellent investigations of a lot of different kinds of issues that we've been talking about. But at this point, at least the Maine State Police takes the position that that's not lawful. And there are other states that have taken that position as well, in California, New York, in litigation. So if you're thinking about hiring an outside person, keep in mind that it's probably going to have to be an attorney to conduct an investigation. And we'll talk about some of the advantages of having counsel or an attorney investigate versus a non-attorney. But obviously, you're not going to want to hire an attorney to do every investigation that you have. So it's a delicate balance. So I mentioned that there are some advantages to having an attorney conduct an investigation, or at least direct the investigation. A lot of times, I'll get a call about a situation, you know, do we need to investigate, and we'll talk about what that investigation should look like, and I'll suggest that it be done at the direction of counsel, which will basically mean I will send them a memo directing them to conduct an investigation for the purpose of getting legal advice. Now, you can't just magically cloak an investigation by contacting an attorney and asking for the investigation to take place. It has to be for some bona fide, it has to be for the purpose of getting legal advice. So some of the situations, if you're really just trying to decide whether or not to discipline an employee, for example, it's probably not going to be privileged, even if an attorney tells you to go do an investigation. A lot of times, it's not clear whether a privilege will apply. I'll go through the process of saying, yes, I'm going to direct you to do an investigation for the purpose of getting legal advice. And if you have to, you fight it out later on as to whether it's actually privileged. And in a lot of cases, frankly, I will be directing an investigation expecting that the investigation and the report will not be privileged, but in fact will be evidence in a case. So if you're defending a sexual harassment case by saying we did a prompt and thorough investigation and took appropriate remedial action, that's part of your defense, you can't also claim that the report and the investigation is privileged. You have to waive the privilege in order to take that position. So it's certainly helpful to call counsel, particularly if it's an investigation of something significant, call counsel in advance and talk it through before you start the investigation. Once you start, it's hard to claim it's a privileged investigation. Allison?
Meg, is this something that's new? Because there's been a lot of HR consultants that I've come in contact with for years that have been doing these investigations.
Is this something that's new, as Allison Briggs, and you're talking about that HR consultants who do not work for the company can't do investigations. It is an emerging issue. I was in a conference in California last year and went to a program on investigations. And this was a big part of the discussion because there had been litigation in that state. Their statute looks not identical, but very close to our statute. Because of that concern, I called the state, Maine State Police, and talked to the people that run the investigations group and the professional investigators licensing process. And that's the opinion I got. So, you know, unless the law is clarified, I mean, they were sympathetic to the argument, but said that's not what the statute says, which is true.
So it's been there, it's just coming to light.
Yes, in a couple of states, and because there's publicity about those cases, other people are looking at it. So I think the way it would come up was if an investigation was done and there was litigation involving the whatever the decision was, if the employee was, let's say, terminated, they may go after the investigator, and one of the claims may be that was not a lawful investigation. So there are penalties associated with a non-licensed person doing an investigation. And, you know, there's some good reasons why you want people who are doing investigations to be licensed by somebody so that they're accountable to somebody if they violate the law in the course of their investigations. But I think there should be more flexibility here. Okay, so when should you contact legal counsel at the outset? Obviously, if a charge with a commission or a lawsuit has been filed or threatened, maybe an attorney letter, you want to have guidance through that investigation. Probably it's going to be privileged as an attorney-client communication and or work product. If there's a significant likelihood of litigation against the company, again, contact counsel. If it's a serious corporate compliance question, such as OSHA, Fair Labor Standards Act, Sarbanes-Oxley, some kind of accounting irregularity at issue. Also, if there is serious criminal behavior that's been alleged, you want to get counsel. You may also want to figure out whether you get law enforcement involved as well. If you have unusual investigative techniques contemplated, any kind of surveillance or anything, you want to call counsel first before you inadvertently violate some state or federal law. If there's allegations of misconduct against somebody who's a senior member of management, you probably want to get guidance then as well. And if the accused is a member of a bargaining unit, collective bargaining unit, you probably want to get counsel, whether in-house or outside, so that you understand what the standards are and what the process is. All right. One of the things I find is helpful to do, particularly if you have an outside investigator coming in, but even if you're asking somebody else within the organization to do an investigation, you want to draft a charge outlining what the scope of the investigation is and the questions to be answered, and if it's appropriate, what is the standard of proof. I find when I'm doing an investigation, particularly for an organization that I'm not connected with, that charge is really important. Sometimes I'll draft it myself, give it to the company that's asking me to investigate, and they'll clarify, or maybe go back and forth. Okay, this is exactly the issue you want me to investigate. And sometimes you may say, and not this issue. carve out some issues. And then in terms of the standard of proof, we have some people here from educational institutions. Sometimes the standard of proof is imposed upon you, such as in a sexual assault case on a college campus. Sometimes you may have the standard of proof in a collective bargaining agreement. Sometimes it may just be your past practice. So is it more likely than not? Do you have to show clear and convincing evidence? Proof beyond a reasonable doubt? You just want to make it clear with the investigator what the standard of proof is. So does the available evidence establish that it is more likely than not, that's the standard of proof, that Janet's allegations against Mike regarding sexual advances and comments are true? If so, were the advances and comments unwelcome to Janet? Now you see here, the charge doesn't say anything about the remedial action. And that's important. You want to be really clear whether with your investigator, if you're asking the investigator just to figure out what the facts are and not to make recommendations as to what their remedial action should be. And in most cases, you probably don't want your investigator making recommendations of remedial action, because often that's going to be decided by someone else or a group of people. They may agree, you know, accept your facts, but not agree with the recommended course of action. And then you may have a problem to explain in litigation. Well, the investigator who actually investigated thought this person should be terminated, and you didn't terminate them. You decided instead to, you know, give them a warning. And it may undermine kind of the weight that the jury would give to the investigation, or it may raise questions about whether or not the employer did the appropriate thing in not terminating the employee. Okay. So the charge to the investigator the investigator should be charged with determining facts, not legal conclusions in most cases. Company officials generally are going to decide if the facts establish a violation of the policy and appropriate remedial action. One of the things you don't want to be doing is trying to make a judgment about whether a statute has been violated. Whether, for example, this arises to the level of being sexual harassment within the meaning of the Maine Human Rights Act. You don't want to draw those conclusions, because you you may conclude that, yes, that what everything she said was true and we're going to fire the employee. But once you declare that this is sexual harassment and the claimant files a lawsuit alleging that you didn't act soon enough or some other reason, you've made an admission that this was sexual harassment, so you've kind of waived that, even though it may, in fact, not have risen anywhere near the level of creating a hostile or offensive work environment. Okay, so you've got the charge, and now you're conducting the investigation. You're going to be, if you're in human resources or a management role, obtaining relevant policies and the collective bargaining agreement, perhaps some personnel file material that you know the investigator's going to need. You want to make sure you're gathering any kind of physical evidence that may be available, and documentary evidence. You want to take steps to preserve that, at least through the investigation. So if there are voicemails and texts and photographs and emails, you'll want to preserve them, not only copies of printouts, but the electronic version, the native format of each of those materials. You may need to keep them if there is litigation threatened. You will need to implement a litigation hold anyway and retain that evidence throughout the course of the litigation. Another thing you need to do is determine whether interim protective measures need to be taken, and that's usually to protect the complainant who's come forward and made a complaint. Or there may be a situation of a potential safety issue, a question about a potential safety issue, and you've got to address it now, not wait for the investigation to be completed. You need to decide, well, should the complainant be allowed to stay out of the workplace while the investigation is going on? Or should you ask the respondent to be placed on administrative leave while the investigation is going on? What you want to make sure you're doing is not penalizing the complainant for coming in and not prejudging the respondent. But at the same time, you've got to keep people safe and not feeling threatened. So it's a judgment call. Typically, I'd start with the complainant and ask him or her, would you prefer to be on paid leave while we do this investigation? If they say yes, it's kind of an easy decision. If not, then you're going to ask, you know, are you comfortable with this investigation going on with so-and-so still in the workplace? If they're not comfortable, then you may have to make a decision to separate them, change their shifts, or have the respondent on leave either paid or unpaid. And again, that's a judgment call. You may decide they can both continue in the workplace, and sometimes there's multiple people involved. They can all stay in the workplace, but there's to be a no-contact directive in place. And I talked about preserving evidence. You may need to have a forensic expert come in. You know, if there's an allegation of accounting fraud, if there are some kind of you find pornographic emails on your system, you may want to have those professionally preserved. So that's a decision to be made. So you start your investigation. Do you always start with a complainant? The order of witness interviews can be very important in some cases, less so in others. Sometimes it's not within your control. You have access to somebody on a certain day only, and that's the day you've got to interview them. In a lot of cases, you want to start with the complainant. You may have some idea of the complaint because you've gotten an email or, you know, a hotline complaint or a report from a manager, but you don't really have a lot of facts. And the only way you can investigate is to know more. So you sit down with the complainant. Other times, you may want to talk to the managers first. To understand the background before you go, or maybe it's a customer who's brought a complaint or a client. So there's not an answer to this question that's appropriate in every case. But most of the time, you're going to start with a complainant. So one of the things to keep in mind is that you may get a complaint about some activity that's been going on in the workplace for months, if not years. This is often true in a harassment claim. One of the things as the investigator you want to keep in mind are the various reasons why somebody may have hesitated for months or years to come forward, and why are they coming forward now. If you've seen me do programs on sexual harassment, you've seen some version of this slide of the various reasons why people may hesitate to come forward. All of which I've seen in my practice, and all of which can be very valid. They're embarrassed. They're afraid of what's going to happen if they complain. The investigation process is intimidating. They don't feel like they're going to be believed. Maybe they were mistaken. They want to handle it themselves. They think they can handle it themselves, or they're hoping it'll go away. I think you're going to retire in a few months. the reason I hear most often when there's been this long delay is I don't want to get anyone in trouble. Or I don't want to be responsible for somebody getting in trouble. Or I don't want to be, you know, that person. I don't want to be retaliated against, and so forth. Or maybe, you know, a sense of guilt. Maybe I maybe I said something that gave them the wrong impression, I'm responsible. So keep in mind, there are a lot of reasons why a person may hesitate. They may, in fact, be so traumatized by events that happened that they just were incapable of coming forward. So the first question you don't want to start out with, why have you waited so long to come forward? One of the reasons they may, in fact, have hesitated is because they were not really offended. They come forward right after being put on a PIP and told that if they don't turn their performance around in 30 days, they're going to be terminated. And then all of a sudden, there are these allegations. As an investigator, that's a hard thing to tease out because there's all these reasons why they may have hesitated. And now they're coming forward because they realize they have nothing to lose. Or maybe they come forward after they've been terminated because they realize they have nothing to lose. So the answer is not necessarily just because they've been put on a PIP that they're just bringing it up now as a offensive move. So as the investigator, you want to be sensitive to the reasons why the complainant may be a reluctant witness. You do that by stressing the importance of protecting somebody against retaliation, and why it's important that even though you're concerned about somebody getting in trouble, your goal is to just make sure that the environment in which they're working is comfortable and conducive to them doing their best work. Part of the interview of the complainant is to get an exhaustive list of the allegations to the extent you can. Because what tends to happen in these cases is you get little dribs and drabs, and then you get to the Human Rights Commission and there's all this other stuff, and then you get to litigation, you get into a lawsuit and there's more stuff. You want to try to pin them down early on to all the allegations. You can ask for copies of their journals or notes that they've taken. A lot of complainants will have done that. You're not necessarily entitled to them, but you can certainly ask. Text messages. Yeah, if they talk about getting text messages from another employee, can you show them to me on their phone? Voicemails, etc. Ideally, you'll get a digital or electronic version of those, of that evidence that you can preserve. But again, they may not be willing to share that. It's helpful in most cases for the complainant to put the complaint in writing. Some complainants will be reluctant to do that or may not be literate enough to do it effectively. So you may have to interview them thoroughly, put together a witness statement to have them review and revise, and then finalize it. Can be critical 2 or 3 years later because they're not going to have the same memory. And if the facts start changing 2 or 3 years later, that would be important. Okay. You want to ask the complainant, who else do you think I should talk to? What do you think they know? You want to ask the complainant what outcome they want to see, making it clear that you can't promise anything, but how do you think this thing should be resolved? Can you think of a way that would be appropriate and comfortable for you? One of the early questions you're going to have when you're questioning witnesses and the complainant sometimes is, do you say what you're actually investigating, particularly to the witnesses? And the answer to that depends upon what exactly you're investigating. A lot of times I'll do an investigation without giving any witness more information than they had before they walked in the room. I will say I'm investigating a concern that's been raised. I'm doing a survey of the work environment, and I'm talking to all the employees in the group, kind of get their impressions. Or sometimes I might say I'm investigating a complaint, but I'm not going to give anybody any more information because I don't want to impugn anybody's reputation unnecessarily. And other times you're going to say, you know, specifically what you're investigating, because it's the only way to get the information from the witnesses. So it'll kind of depend on the situation, but you want to think that out ahead of time before you get there. I have had situations where one in particular, CFO was accused of making sexual advances to a subordinate in a bar after work. It was in a bank. And so I went in and investigated, and rather than saying, you know, so-and-so has been accused of making sexual advances to Judy, I was doing a survey of the work environment. And I would say there has been a complaint about the workplace environment. And I got all sorts of information about other kind of situations. One guy came in and said, I know you're investigating me. And I made the statement, and it was a stupid thing to say, and he went on and on. I didn't tell him that wasn't what I was investigating. So it can be done. Sometimes it's not the most direct way to do it. So the other question you have... Okay. Is it okay to record your sessions with witnesses? That's a good question. I think I have it on a slide coming up, but you can with permission. I find Mainers are kind of skittish about tape recording. It kind of shuts them up more than makes them talk. So I don't do it very often. Legally, you can record your investigation even without their permission, in Maine anyway, because Maine is a one-party consent state. In other states, if you're, you know, interviewing somebody, one of your out-of-state employees, you'd have to find out whether that's legal in that state. And if you're doing it by phone, it gets more complicated because you have both, you know, potentially two states, laws that may conflict on this issue. So you want to be really clear if you're tape recording that you've complied with applicable law. But generally I find, I know some investigators routinely tape record, and it's certainly a helpful tool to the investigator to have that recording later on. You can open yourself up to issues, however, if you're in litigation later on, because not only is the witness statement recorded, your questions are being recorded, and you know, a skilled plaintiff's lawyer can make hay with the way you asked your questions and your tone and things you didn't ask and so forth. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. It was a good question. Okay. One of the things you want to make sure you tell every witness during the interview and make a record that you've told them is that that retaliation against a person for participating in an investigation will not be tolerated and is unlawful, and give them information about what to do if they feel they're being retaliated against. Obviously, it's not unlawful to take action against somebody who's found to have engaged in misconduct. That's different from disciplining someone who's just because they participated in the investigation. So, Chris.
Sorry, just one question on the previous slide. Can you just talk briefly about the second bullet about construction of the confidentiality?
This is an evolving issue, the issue of confidentiality. I'd say, you know, 20 years ago, we always told every employee witness that you are not to talk about anything said in this investigation outside of this conversation, or talk about the, you know, the allegations, the harassment allegations, whatever they are, outside of this room, and you could be disciplined for doing that. There's been some pushback on that, both at the NLRB level and the EEOC level. EEOC taking the position, you know, silencing witnesses. You can think of like a Me Too situation. Makes it difficult for employees to get remedial action. They have sometimes a right and a need to talk to each other, to share stories and so forth. So you could run into some issues there. On the NLRA side, you may have an issue about equal pay, some other kind of working conditions, and employees have Section 7 rights to talk or engage in concerted protected activity about working conditions and wages. So there could be an issue there. It's generally safe to say, do not talk about this matter while the investigation is pending. Most courts, at least, will take the position that that's not impeding employees' rights to engage in concerted protected activity or to address their Title VII rights, for example. Good question. So, how do you conduct your investigations? I have a visual cue of how not to do it. You don't think you want to decide, you know, conduct these like a Perry Mason episode. There may be situations where you got to get kind of aggressive with a witness, but those are going to be few and far between. You're trying to gather information, facts, get people to talk. So you're going to be wanting to make them as comfortable as possible, particularly the claimants and the witnesses, and sometimes the respondent as well. So, you know, the way you would ordinarily conduct a conversation when you have a problem and you're trying to understand it is going to be fine. You want to use open-ended questions, not leading questions. You know, why did you do that? Why did you say that? What happened next? Can you give me a little more information about what happened in that conversation? I think it's helpful to have prepared questions so that you make sure you ask everything you need to ask, but you don't want to be a slave to them. You've got to be flexible enough to follow up on something the witness has said, and it might take you down a different angle than you thought you were going. You do typically want to interview witnesses one-on-one, not a group. They can obviously all affect each other, and I've seen people do an investigation where they got everybody in a room and ask them all questions, and they answered, and that's probably not going to be very effective if the investigation has some defensive purposes. We talked about multiple investigators. It's important as the investigator that you at all times project a very neutral approach to the issue. Neutral with the complainant, neutral with the witnesses, neutral with the respondent, until you've closed your investigation and then you make a determination. And this slide says, you know, use a tape recorder only where needed and when disclosed to everyone in the room. But again, I find that you ask if you can tape record and people will suddenly get nervous and, you know, they suddenly want their lawyer there or, you know, it just puts them on edge or they just don't say as much as they would if you weren't recording. Of course, keep in mind that the person you're talking to may be tape recording the conversation and not telling you. So keep that in mind. If you're investigating particularly allegations of abuse, either sexual abuse, physical abuse, you may have a victim complainant who is traumatized. And it's important to keep that in mind. This is particularly important to sexual assault investigations. And so what you want to be doing with those is taking a little more care to make sure that the environment is comfortable, that they feel safe in the environment. You may have to give them more information about what you're going to be asking and that it might be difficult and they can take breaks if they need to, so forth. They may need to have a support person in the room, and maybe you have a rule against that generally, but that may be something you're going to have to be flexible on. Keep in mind that someone who's been traumatized may not have the same affect as you would expect. They may not remember details that you would think they would remember. They can't necessarily put things in chronological order, and that doesn't necessarily mean that they're not telling the truth. It's impaired their ability to recall events, and they may have things chronologically mixed up. So you've got to be sensitive to that issue and not say, well, you know, she said this thing happened on such and such a day and something else happened the next day and it was actually not true and therefore she's lying. That you may need to take a somewhat different approach when there's a potential that the victim has been traumatized. So I mentioned support people, and you may have a request by the complainant, by any of the witnesses, by any of the respondents, to have someone with them when they're being questioned. If they're a member of a collective bargaining unit, they may have the right to have somebody present, and it's usually a union steward. If not, it's a judgment call. I typically discourage attorneys accompanying employees to these kind of investigations, but I've used outside investigators or other attorneys who have said I'm perfectly comfortable with having the attorney there as long as they understand their role is not to answer the questions, but to be there as an observer. Sometimes, particularly if you have a minor who is the employee who's come forward with a complaint, that minor may need to have a parent or might want a parent to attend. And sometimes that's more helpful to have the parent there too, to help the minor deal with the situation. Sometimes you might allow an employee to bring a coworker just because it's emotional support. Again, particularly if you have a potentially traumatized victim, maybe even a counselor. So those are things to think about, and I think you just need to be flexible and strategic about that. Once you start allowing people to have another person there, though, you've got to be even-handed about it for that investigation. So you could get yourself in trouble if you say, yes, the complainant can have a support person there, but the accused could not. Some no-nos conducting investigations. No suggestion, you cannot make a suggestion even that the employee undergo a polygraph examination. That is by statute not allowed as in the workplace context. Law enforcement can do it, employers cannot. You cannot engage in surveillance or GPS tracking. A licensed professional investigator may be able to do it under certain circumstances, but only with permission of people whose property is being surveilled. You have to make sure you're complying with both state and federal laws. You don't want to engage in any unauthorized intrusion into social media. If an employee or student gives you social media that they had access to, that's fair game. But you don't want to be asking people for their passwords and gaining access to their social media unless they permit you to. No unauthorized background checks. So you don't want to be using a third party to conduct a criminal background check if it hasn't been authorized by the subject. Can you look on the internet for things? Yes. There may be reasons why you do or you don't want to do that. But you want to make sure that if you're doing any kind of background checks with a third party, you've complied with the Fair Credit Reporting Act. False imprisonment. It sounds kind of severe, but it can happen more than you would think. And that has to do with putting a person in a position where they feel that they have no ability to retreat, to leave the room. So if you're blocking the door and the employee is sitting there and feels stuck, not allowed to leave, that could give rise to a claim for false imprisonment. So you want to just, you know, set up the room so that, you know, the person, if they want to leave, they can leave. And you can tell them that, you know. The question in the back.
Can you speak a little bit more about the unauthorized intrusion into social media? Does that exclude publicly available information? So okay. I've been able to glean some really interesting information from people's public Facebook pages, things like that, Instagram.
Yep.
Is that carved out from what you have?
So the question is to talk a little bit more about unauthorized intrusion into social media, and can you look at publicly available information, whether it's on a Facebook page or a LinkedIn page or the Portland police beat. That's all fair game. It's out there. Now you want to make sure that if you're relying on anything, that you've drilled down and made sure it was true. I had a situation about a year ago where there was a report to the owner of a company, a restaurant, that somebody they just hired was a convicted felon and had been just gotten out of prison for drug dealing. And the restaurant employed a bunch of minors, and this was a problem. What the owner did was have one of her employees go to the local courthouse, ask for the files on this person, looked at these files, found out, yes, she was in fact convicted, yes, she went to jail, she's been released. That person was terminated, and an attorney was threatening to bring a claim that there would have been a violation of the Fair Credit Reporting Act because she didn't authorize the background check. Well, the answer to that is that's not a violation. You can go to the courthouse and do it yourself and look for the criminal conviction. So, and similarly, social media. What employers shouldn't be doing is pressuring employees to gain access to something that you haven't actually been given. But again, if an employee comes to you, and you're going to get this a lot, see printed out their Facebook page, look at this comment that this employee made, that's going to be fair game. Maybe a racial slur, and you haven't pressured anybody to get that information, you can use it. The other thing you want to keep in mind is you don't want to be disclosing any of the information you learn to anybody but those in the need to know. The control group, people making the decisions, or legal counsel. If you disclose it any further, you can open yourself up to a defamation claim. Question back there.
Just in regards to the surveillance side of things, if you have video only, no auditory, are you able to utilize that?
Okay. The question is, if you have surveillance that's video only, can you use it? Absolutely. If it was installed in a place where you're legally allowed to have it installed, under Maine law, for example, you have the right to have video surveillance, but not in places that a person would expect to be private, like a restroom, locker room. You also cannot surveil property that's not yours without the landowner's permission. Question up here.
Yeah, Meg, just as a follow-up to that, do we have an obligation to have the employee sign anything that they're, you know, acknowledging that they're under surveillance, or like at the time you're on company property, you will be...
The question is, do we have an obligation to let employees know that you're being surveilled, if in fact you're doing the surveillance? That's a state-by-state issue. Generally... You don't have that obligation, but some states you do have an obligation to let them know. A lot of employers, so that there's no allegation that their privacy has been invaded, employers will let them know that the premises are being being protected by video surveillance. Usually it's for a safety issue. You can explain it to employees. Sometimes you'll put a plaque up. Some states require you to put a plaque up. These premises are being surveyed by video. So that's a good question. 30? Okay. I often will be talking to an HR manager about an investigation that had been done in the past, and now there's litigation. And I get the response, well, I investigated, and it was a he said, she said. And there was no other substantiating evidence, so I couldn't take any action. This is not a sufficient answer in a lot of cases. If you're doing an investigation, you've got to make some credibility determinations. So I asked that human resource manager, well, was the complainant believable? Oh, yeah, very believable. Was the respondent credible? Not really. But I couldn't find any evidence to pin the allegations to. There were no witnesses and so forth. Again, you've got to make a credibility determination, and it may be a hard one. But that's what the investigator does. That's the point of the investigation. So the fact that there's no other, the evidence is in conflict and there's no other corroborating evidence may not be enough to say, I'm not going to take any action. Particularly if you have, if you make the credibility determination that her statements were very credible, lots of detail, so forth, and his response was very vague, angry, inconsistent. Even though there's no other evidence, you may need to take the position that the allegations are credible, more likely than not. I recall an HR manager being on the stand after doing a investigation into racial harassment, and that investigator, human resource manager, had concluded, well, you know, he was saying that these racial slurs were being made and so forth, but nobody else heard them, and they were denied, and so I couldn't take any action. Well, the jury found that, in fact, racial harassment had been taking place, and the company had not taken any corrective action, and therefore the company was liable. So that's a situation in which you may have to make that hard credibility determination. So how do you make the credibility determination? One question you got to ask yourself is the witness's statement inherently plausible? Does it make sense? Or is it so fantastic that no reasonable person would believe it? You want to consider, and these are factors that the EEOC says should be taken into consideration when doing an investigation. You want to consider demeanor. Keep in mind that can be tricky, particularly when you've got the traumatized victim. Demeanor may be flat. It may not be what you expect. You're not going to be an expert in detecting whether somebody's telling the truth or not. But the demeanor may be something that you can take into account. Also, you know, you've got to make a decision whether the particularly the respondent, is willing to accept any responsibility for what's happened, has any insight into his or her behavior or not. You want to look at motive. Is there a motive for this particular complainant to falsify the allegations? Keeping in mind that slide we looked at a little while ago where there's a lot of reasons why somebody didn't come forward. Is there a reason why they're fabricating the allegations? Then you can ask the respondent, you know, can you think of any reason why this person would have fabricated these allegations? You may get some very interesting information that could really play to that. Is there any corroboration? That's always helpful to have corroboration evidence. I'm writing a submission in a sexual harassment case now where there was an allegation of sexual harassment, two different occasions, and that, you know, it created a hostile work environment. And then I have a text from the employee to her alleged harasser 2 months after the last incident of harassment where she's inviting him to go with her to the beach to drink wine after work, in a very flirtatious kind of way. So that kind of undermines the credibility that she was, you know, offended and intimidated by this person's sexual advances. And the reputation for truthfulness can be a factor, the EEOC says, to take into consideration, particularly if you know both employees. And if you know that the you know, the complainant has lied about other things, you take that into consideration. If you know that the respondent has lied about things, you're going to take that into consideration. It's not easy making credibility determinations keep you up at night, but sometimes you have to make the hard decision. And keeping in mind that the investigator, you may be asked just to find facts or to make recommendations on corrective action. Or both. We've talked about how, as an investigator, you don't want to draw any legal conclusions. Any legal conclusion can be considered an admission by the employer that a violation of laws occurred. So you want to avoid a statement like Sam created a hostile work environment, or engaged in sexual harassment, or the company's overtime policy violates the Fair Labor Standards Act. So you just want to outline the facts as you found them. Sometimes when I retain an outside investigator, I will ask the investigator just to come up with the facts, but I may have a discussion with him or her after they've done the investigation as to what they think might be appropriate remedial action. I don't have that in writing because I don't necessarily know what the employer is going to want to do. But that investigator's insight might be really helpful to understand, you know, where's the complainant? If you don't fire the respondent, will the complainant be able to continue to work there? Does the respondent seem to understand that, you know, his or her actions, even though maybe not malicious, made somebody else uncomfortable? Are they willing to change their behavior? Those things are really important. An investigator, as the investigator, you might be asking the respondent, would you be willing to, let's say, sit down with the complainant and apologize? And the response is, I have nothing to apologize for. You know, it's too bad that she's so sensitive. That's information you probably want to keep include in your report. You're not necessarily recommending one thing or another, but the decision maker needs to know that. And I will usually ask the investigator that. In your materials, I gave you one page. It was a separate document. I don't know if you picked it up. It's a Word document, and it's a suggested format for a report. Can you get them? People didn't. Raise your hand if you didn't get one of those. Yeah, a few people. Okay. I find it sometimes difficult to start writing a report with a blank piece of paper. How am I going to structure this and so forth? And so this is just a guide to help you think through the actual report. If there's going to be any suggestion of litigation, the investigative report is critical. I find I get reports to review a lot, and I find that a lot of them are so cryptic that nobody outside the organization could understand what happened and who said what to whom. And you've got to keep in mind who your audiences are. Your potential audience may be senior management, who's going to make a decision about what to do. It may be one or more of the employees' attorneys who are thinking of bringing action or defending actions. It may be the Maine Human Rights Commission. It may be a judge or a jury. And so the thing to keep in mind is to tell the story so that anybody outside the company will understand what happened. And it's probably going to seem unnecessary for the purposes of advising senior management about what to do, but it's going to be critical later on. I've had a number of situations where the litigation doesn't arise till years later, and it may bear upon the investigation that was done a couple of years before, and nobody who was involved in the investigation is still employed. And so employers stuck with this very vague and confusing, rambling summary or stack of notes, which is not very helpful. So I have pressured people to get the investigation done, and it's critical. I had a situation recently where an investigation was done. It was allegations of sexual abuse of clients. And there were a lot of people interviewed, and I got a bunch of witness summaries that were difficult to follow, but pressured them to put together a coherent investigation report, which we had. And years later, that became an issue, and it was critical. And none of the people that were involved in the investigation were still with the company, but we had a report that an arbitrator could read and understand, and that was critical. So not every investigation is going to need this kind of detailed report. Some of them are going to be really kind of brief, but some of them it's going to be really important that you have detailed information. You gather the exhibits that you looked at, the evidence, you keep them all in one place. When you're drafting your report, one of the things you want to think about is whether it's going to be important to attribute statements to specific witnesses or not. So the question is whether an employee is entitled to the employer's investigation. That's a good question. Again, this is a state-by-state analysis. If the employee is disciplined as a result of an investigation under Maine law and the laws of some states but not others, the report is considered part of that employee's personnel file, regardless of where it's stored. And so in response to a request for a personnel file, yes, you may have to turn it over. There is a law court decision on point in this case involving Walmart, Harding versus Walmart, in which a company, Walmart, did an investigation into suspected theft and interviewed a number of employees who all were very apprehensive about disclosing information, but did, under a promise of confidentiality. And so the employer, after the there was an employee who was fired as a result, and the employee asked for the file, and the employer said, no, we're not turning it over, it's confidential. That went up to the law court, and the law court said that the statute requires you to turn over, as part of the personnel file, any formal or informal reports relating to that employee. And the court was said, you know, the legislature didn't say you could redact things. It didn't say you could withhold a report on the basis of confidentiality, or that employees are fearful of retaliation. So that's the state of the law in Maine. So it's going to be a state by state analysis. I think you have to keep in mind that the employees. Probably, if there's an employee who's going to be disciplined, probably going to be entitled to the report. In a lot of contexts, the complainant is also going to be entitled to the report, even though it's not necessarily a report that leads to discipline of the employee. So, Jonna.
Can you redact the names of the witnesses to protect them?
That's unclear under Maine law. Have I done it? Yes, many times. And then we have an argument with opposing counsel about whether or not I can do that. And so far I haven't had to
litigate that issue. But if it's really important that the employee's identities be protected, I do. Now, another way to avoid that problem is not to attribute statements to a particular witness in your report. So you summarize the facts, and you may list the people you talked to, you interviewed, but you don't attribute any statements to any particular individuals. And that may be done deliberately because you're really concerned about attribution and because you want to protect the individuals who participated in the investigation. It's important as the investigator that you understand the limits of confidentiality. So you tell the employee that you're investigating, I'm going to try to keep this as confidential as possible, but I do have to write a report and I'm going to give it to Human Resources or the CEO. And I can't necessarily promise you that any employee who's involved in this won't be able to have access to it at some point. So you want to be thinking when you're drafting your report how much information you actually want to have in it. Okay. How are we doing with time? 12, okay. Allison?
Can you have a report and have your cast of characters in a separate HR that has, here's my cast of characters related to that. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't have a copy of that, right? If you wrote your report and didn't want to include names, but you want to, 6 months, a year later, remember who cast of characters, you can have a separate just listing who's associated with that investigation.
Can you have a separate listing of who's associated with that investigation? Yeah, it's not clear whether you would win that argument in response to litigation over a personnel file. If you went to litigation, you'd have to turn over everything related to that investigation, most likely. So I did an investigation recently where it was an issue within a large human resources department, and I talked to almost everybody, and there was a lot of apprehension about who was going to know what I said. So I promised, and I followed up with that because it was part of my directive, that I would not attribute any statements to any witness. And I just had bullet marks, and I quoted things, and I tried to leave out details that might give somebody a clue as to who said what. Now, I had the notes in my office. Would I have had to turn them over? Unclear. But I did such a good job that like a year later I was trying to figure out who said what and I had no idea. I had to find my key. So yeah, this is something to think about, and yeah, sometimes the report is not going to be very helpful unless you're attributing statements to individuals and have specific facts, and you're just going to have to let employees know, you know, I'm going to try to keep this as confidential as possible, but I can't guarantee you that, you know, the report won't be seen by others. So we talked about understanding your audiences for your report, the judge, jury, employees, lawyers, affected employees, the employer, and draft it accordingly. Some tips for doing an effective report. I've talked about this a little bit. Tell the story as if the reader knows nothing about your organization or the actors or the situations. And sometimes that means specifically naming names and dates and explaining, you know, some workflow process that's gone wrong, get a little background about what you're talking about. Sometimes we tend to talk in acronyms, and there's so many acronyms you can't, a person that's not familiar with the company can't understand it. Use grammatically correct sentences and avoid being too cryptic. There's been many times where I've got a report which is, it's basically a summary of maybe witness statements, but the, you know, the statements may not have been all that grammatically correct when they were made, but the interviewer understood what they were saying. When you write the report, you got to be a little bit more clear about your understanding of what they were saying.
your factual findings should be factual and not generalizations, specifics, and not loaded or judgmental. Sometimes details, little details, can be critical. You may have a text that was sent on a particular time and with a particular phrasing that puts everything in context. So sometimes those little details can be really important. And ultimately, you want to ask yourself, would the reader reading the investigation appreciate that the investigation was thorough, careful, objective, fair, and that the conclusions were reasoned and justifiable? Because ultimately, particularly if you're ending up in front of a jury and this is your defense, that's what they're going to be looking at. In a lot of contexts, an employer may take action based on an investigation and they are wrong. They got the facts wrong, they got the conclusions wrong, or arguably wrong. And the litigation is over whether or not the termination was appropriate or whether it was just a pretext for age discrimination or whatever the theory may be. And the question is, well, you know, is the investigation entitled to any deference? The case law is very helpful generally in this area. And most courts would agree that if the employer had an honest, good faith belief that the misconduct had occurred, then that's a defense to a discrimination claim, even if they were wrong. So again, your investigation needs to be compelling and detailed to show why you do the conclusions you did. If you have a different person or a group of people making a decision about the outcome, you want to have that summarized as well. What was it that drove your decision to terminate or not to terminate? And the good faith defense to a claim of discrimination can be extraordinarily helpful if you have a good report that is going to be credited by the court. So finally, documenting the remedial action. Even though I've said under Maine law an investigation report is part of an employee's personnel file, that employee's been disciplined as a result, I would recommend never putting the actual report into a personnel file, keeping them separate in secure locations. If there is discipline, however, as a result of an investigation, you want to separately document that and the reasons for the discipline and put that in the personnel file of the person who's been disciplined. You never want to put a documentation of a complaint in the employee's file who made the complaint unless it's part of, you know, a discipline over a false complaint. So, you know, an employee could argue that, you know, the fact you put my complaint in my personnel file opened other managers up to seeing that I had made a complaint and put me in a position to be retaliated against or discriminated against. So, and unless the complainant is being disciplined for knowingly making false accusations, no part of the investigation should be put in that claimant's file. There should be no record of it that another supervisor can say, oh, they made a say. She made a sexual harassment complaint against so-and-so. Okay. Any general questions, either from our listening audience or our seated audience? You've had some good questions today. I appreciate that. Okay, well, I'm going to be around for a few minutes if you want to come up and talk about something specific, but I really appreciate your time and attention. Have a great day.